Senate File 3. It's Friday, February 28th, and we're almost on time. It's close to 3. What we planned today was we're going to accommodate some people's schedules, so we will be ending by 4 at the latest. I want to get some public testimony, and then we will listen to some information from the Office of Labor and Industry. I think that's it. So we could start with whoever, Ben Gerber from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce.
He's not here.
Yep, I see him. Okay. Thank you. How are you?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Benjamin Gerber. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I want to thank you for having me here today. Although it was short notice on the meeting, we had one of our members who couldn't actually come today submit a letter, and I believe it's in your packets. If not, I have extra copies here. And one of the things I wanted to talk about is that a lot of the focus has been on large business, but this impacts small businesses across the state just as well. The letter that hopefully you have in front of you is from a business called Touching Hearts at Home. They provide non-medical in-home care for people with disabilities and senior citizens who want to stay at home but are not able to fulfill all their needs themselves. And what their concern is that they already currently pay above minimum wage, although their starting wage is below the House proposal of $9.50. And what this would do, a radical increase to $9.50, as the Chamber believes and as this business believes, would really hurt their clients the most. They're working with people that are on fixed incomes and people that aren't able to provide for themselves or enter the workforce. And with this radical increase, they would have to increase their prices, and their clients are not necessarily able to absorb those. The result of this for some of these people, I mean, we obviously can't speak for all of them, but it could be moving out of their homes into other facilities and things like that. And one of the things that I'm not going to get into studies. We've already debated that through all the various committees, and we can battle with those. Although I suggested everybody, and I'm glad to see that it's on the table here, the Department of Labor Industries study that goes through all that data, and I think in a very good form. But the biggest concern that we really have at the Chamber is the inflation indexer. One of the things that I find difficult to, and some of the businesses I've spoke to, and hopefully at another committee we can bring some more business, another hearing, bring some more businesses in, is tying the wage to the inflation adjustment and using the United States urban consumer's average wage. I think that doesn't reflect first of all, it doesn't reflect the state of Minnesota. It's a U.S. urban average, so I think there's a problem there. The Bureau of Labor Statistics provides county by county and statewide inflation adjustment. So, but more than that, it doesn't recognize the fact that that this is not a great way to set something on autopilot. One of the things that I'd like to point you to is the Boskin report that was submitted, I believe, in 1996, the U.S. Senate, which actually looked at the BLS study and showed that it overestimates inflation by about 1% a year. And so there is evidence that it's not a great use of and a really dangerous thing to tie minimum wage to. And I'd like to address something that I believe Senator Hayden, who isn't here right now, but asked a previous testifier, what would they prefer? And we would prefer federal conformity. Our board has adopted that policy. I find it hard to believe, and I've heard people say this, that, well, federal conformity isn't doing anything, but I've also heard those same people say that Minnesota has the lowest minimum wage in the country, and we should be ashamed of that. So I don't think those two things are contradictory to each other. I think if you are not going to adopt federal conformity, then the next best thing would be the Senate bill. Again, we have serious reservations in the businesses that I've talked to, serious reservations about the inflation indexing. And then if you go above and beyond what the Senate does, which we believe from the business community's perspective is really concerning, is to use caution and really think critically about what you're going to do to the businesses in the state.
Thank you, Mr. Kirk. Are there any questions from anyone for Mr. Kirk? Okay, thank you. Our next person on the list is Dan McElroy from the Minnesota Hospitality Association.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I do have some handouts if there is a page available, and I have, I hope, extra copies for the audience. And I have three documents, a history of inflation, some arguments about inflation, and some interesting information about youth unemployment. Madam Chair and members, for the record, my name is Dan McElroy. I work for a coalition of three trade associations, and together we are called Hospitality Minnesota. But our members are members of the Minnesota Restaurant Association, the Minnesota Lodging Association, and the Minnesota Resort and Campground Association. All of them have taken a position that has five components. And you heard about some of them last night from our members, Ed Fong from David Fong's restaurant, Mike Jennings from a number of restaurants in the western suburbs, and Sam Leon, the only Hispanic Minnesotan who operates an Irish pub, and also eight other Mexican restaurants with his eight brothers and sisters. So I'm going to concentrate. Let me review briefly the position that the three associations take. But I want to concentrate on our concern about youth and young people and about inflation and the competition with surrounding states. But we've joined with the Chamber and a long list of other business groups to urge caution in the overall rate. We agree. We understand that it's not likely that you're going to adopt federal conformity, but restraint is important, and we do compete for retail business, for restaurant customers, for lodging guests with surrounding states, and the comparison of the states around us is important. Secondly, you heard last night about the importance of protecting the good-paying tipped employee jobs that we have. The Department of Labor and Industry estimates that there are about 39,000 people working in eating and drinking establishments that earn the minimum wage. Many, perhaps most of those, also earn tips. So although they're paid at the minimum hourly wage, the earnings are higher than that. And the propensity of those jobs to be changed either through formatting or automation increases as the minimum wage gets higher. We also would urge caution, as does the Chamber, on the issue of inflation. I'll talk about that in just a moment. We're strong supporters of the Senate position on a youth wage and thank them for adopting that. It is important that we recognize that young Minnesotans, when they're 15, 16, 17, and 18, learn to work outside the home, learn work habits that are helpful to them for the rest of their lives. We also would hope that whatever wage rate that you compromise on between the Senate position and the House position, that it be implemented over 3 or 4 years so that there is some time for the adjustments that need to be made, whether it's to prices or technology or a variety of things, so that the business systems can implement the changes that are needed for businesses to continue to exist and provide jobs in an orderly fashion as possible. Let me start, and Representative Winkler and I have had this discussion in a number of forums about youth unemployment rates. And the data that you see on this landscape chart, and I put it's from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, where I probably should have put my name on it or the association, but it is 2012 data, the latest the BLS has released, with unemployment rates for 16 to 24-year-olds, and then broken down 16 to 19, 19 to 24. They vary by state. They are in states that have both a high minimum wage and don't recognize tips. We do see higher youth unemployment rates, and we're concerned about that. And we think the Senate position helps ameliorate that condition. I also would, and I'm happy if you have questions, I'll try and answer them. Second, we handed out an illustration of inflation over a long period of time. A portion of an editorial from the Star Tribune urging that we not put the minimum wage on autopilot, that you retain the ability to set it on a regular basis. One of the concerns we have is that if we index our inflation, our minimum wage for inflation, and neighboring states do not, and it doesn't appear that any of them are moving to do so, with the possible exception of South Dakota, that over time our inflation or our minimum wage starts to walk away and become even less competitive or less comparable to the states around us. One alternative, I understand the concern that labor and others have, that if we don't put the some sort of provision for increasing the wage in, it sits too long without being addressed. An option to putting it on autopilot is something that has been done with inflation in the state forecast, and that's to require that it be reported as part of each forecast for an informational basis and so it can be discussed. And rather than putting subjecting the minimum wage to inflation, I would urge you to consider as an option directing the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry to report to you in each year after the phase-in. And say the phase-in is through 2017, say starting then in 2018 on an annual basis, to get a public report issued by the Commissioner of the Department of Labor to the House and Senate and to be made public, to be provided to all the interested parties as to what inflation has been since the last time the minimum wage was adjusted, what the minimum wage may be in surrounding states, and some estimate of the impact of adjusting the rate at that time for inflation. One of the concerns I think we should be sensitive to is that and even if, for example, we were to set an inflator that was CPI or some number, whichever is less, we still end up with the problem that Washington and Oregon had in 2009, where they had fairly significant inflation in 2007, 2008, and then took a significant increase in their minimum wage in the teeth of the deepest recession we've had since World War II, and perhaps exacerbated the situation by having it on autopilot. So those are the arguments that we would make for not indexing and perhaps an option that you would consider to indexing. With that, Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to share some thoughts with you and your members.
Thank you, Mr. McElroy. Any questions from the members?
Just curiosity. Mr. McElroy, it says in 2009 that it went down 0.4%. Did Oregon's minimum wages then go down also that year?
Not under the language in the House bill, as we read it,
no,
that
mean,
it can only
I mean,
go up.
I mean, in Oregon, did it go down?
No, it went up in 9 because of the increase in 7 and 8.
Did it go down in 10 then?
I don't think so. I believe, and Senator, I'd be happy to check with them. I expect it to stay, that it stayed the same in 10, but I don't know for sure.
Okay. And this page here, these are percentages? Is that what these are?
Those are, that's correct.
Okay.
And those come from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. They're what's called the U3 rate, the kind of generally accepted definition of unemployment.
Anything else? Okay, thank you. Lene Gale, or Leanne, or however you say it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Liane Gale, and I'm a Green Party activist, and I'm also a former PhD research scientist who worked at the University of Minnesota. I would like to remind those members of the committee who belong to the DFL that the DFL platform supports a minimum wage that keeps pace with inflation and provides full-time workers with an income above poverty levels. To be not poor, people need to earn enough money to afford them the necessities for a dignified life. This is certainly not possible with the current state minimum wage. It is not possible with the 775 Senate version, and it is also not possible with a 950 House version. These are all poverty wages. Again, the 950 per hour would not put an end to poverty wages here in Minnesota. As Representative Winkler mentioned yesterday, 40% of Minnesota jobs now pay $14 or less. Let's be honest, these are all poverty wages, and they all contribute to rising inequality, a major issue in the United States. For example, you may be familiar with the statistics that 95% of income gains in the last 5 years went to the top 1%. Inequality continues to increase, and the modest minimum wage increases that are being discussed here and elsewhere will not reverse this trend. I'm currently taking an online class which is called Sustainable Development, taught by Jeffrey Sachs. He's a world-renowned professor of economics, a leader in sustainable development, and director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University. He considers social inclusion as a pillar of sustainability. Therefore, inequality is not sustainable. I'm asking the question, who allows the economy to exploit people and the planet? Isn't it time we put the economy in service of the people, while at the same time dealing respectfully with the planet? Isn't it time we put people before profit? I'm also asking the representatives here, where does your primary responsibility lie? Is it with the people or is it with the corporations? The DFL has a very rare supermajority. Governor Dayton is on the record with his support of living wages. Minnesota has long been considered a progressive bellwether. You have a unique opportunity here to do something significant for working men and women. It is what everybody morally deserves, the prospect of a dignified life. Be courageous. Lead our state and our nation in securing the right of every worker to earn a decent living. It would be entirely in your power to enact the Minnesota Living Wage Act of 2014.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Are there any questions from members? Thank you. Jamie Poole, president of the Minnesota Grocers Association.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. First of all, I'd like to introduce myself, Jamie Poole, president, Minnesota Grocers Association. I want to thank this committee for having the foresight to listen to both pros and cons on this. I know for a conference committee to take testimony, it's unusual, and we appreciate the opportunity to share. The Minnesota Grocers Association is a state trade association. We have represented the retail food industry for over 115 years. We have over 200 retail members with 1,100 stores statewide, as well as about 115 distribution and manufacturer partners. Our members employ both union and non-union members to the number of 125,000 Minnesotans. We are very blessed in the state of Minnesota. We have a unique culture. We still have a strong independent base. Many of our partners across the nation don't share this. They're locally owned grocery convenience stores. These are the cornerstones of their community. They create jobs. They support local charities. They provide a safe and responsible shopping experience. We are the backbone of the Minnesota economy. We provide one out of every 20 jobs in this state. 80% of the grocery stores employ fewer than 50 workers. Grocery and convenience stores are more than just a retail outlet. We employ young people looking for a first-time job, seniors looking for some additional spending income, and developmentally challenged individuals looking for opportunity. Everyone remembers that first job, their first boss, the first pride of that first paycheck. Youth workers ages 16 to 24 hold nearly one-third of grocery store jobs. This age group is regulated by the child labor laws that dictate the hours that the tasks that 14 to 18-year-olds can perform. I believe in your packets from yesterday you were provided a copy of what those labor laws look like, along with our talking points and the state laws. So we have to disseminate those, which we're certainly happy to do. But what that does is restrict what those workers can do, the hours that they can perform, and the duties that they can do. For example, they can't climb on ladders, they can't go in the freezers or operate the paper balers. So our concern is that with these limitations, when you look at raising the wage to the level of $9.50, when they cannot do the same as the other workers, that's not an appropriate increase. And it will restrict our ability to hire. Trends in youth employment are already in serious jeopardy. Based on statistics from the Minnesota Department of Economic Development, individuals between the ages of 16 and 19 have the highest rate of unemployment in the state at nearly 15%. We're concerned that an entire generation of Minnesotans are not going to be given that opportunity to gain valuable first-time experience. We operate on a profit margin of around 1%. So to put that in perspective, that's about a penny for every dollar. The increase in payroll costs will severely affect our ability to succeed in this challenging marketplace, and our marketplace is changing. We're a traditional grocer. We provide service. We've got general merchandisers coming in that are worldwide companies that don't offer that same service. And by looking at an elevated wage like this, we're going to have to either increase our prices or we're not going to be able to provide those services that give us the differentiation that makes our independent grocer succeed. These formulas that we have to provide to have a viable business are dictated. And you heard yesterday from our two testifiers, who were two very nervous store managers, that explained to you what would happen at their stores. A nearly 40% increase in wages over a 2 to 3 year period is not absorbable. And we're concerned about the unintended consequences. Though you're lifting the wages, you're also going to be lifting the food prices comparably. And this also could reduce the job opportunities. The link to inflation is also a current concern. We have a Florida grocer that also operates here in Minnesota. They do link to inflation there. He had to reduce his work staff by 20%, and those that did keep their jobs, there was another 3% reduction in their hours. He had to do this to stay viable in the marketplace. Communities along the border states also have a potential to be at a direct disadvantage. And I know we heard yesterday that restaurants, they may not cross the border because they may like their local restaurant. What we do know from the lift in tobacco taxes that people will cross the border to buy food products, to buy their tobacco. And while they're over there, they're also going to purchase gasoline. They're going to possibly purchase clothing. And those are Minnesota dollars crossing borders. So we're very concerned about that. Again, this is because the lift in wage is going to make our prices go up. We work diligently as an industry to promote good civic stewardship. We pride ourselves in offering great careers with good paying benefits. We are concerned about the outcomes of this conference committee. We ask that you take a thoughtful approach. As an industry, we have supported, and I'm sure many of you have heard from our members, the Senate version, and we please ask that you consider that as you move forward in the process. I'm happy to answer any questions, and of course, our members are always happy to answer any questions you may have in the future as well. Thank you.
Thank you. I believe Representative Metza has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering if you raised everything in the store by one penny, would that cover wages, in your opinion, the increase to $9.50?
Madam Chair, Representative Metza, I can't tell you the answer to that, but I would have to venture to guess that it is not going to be enough. Because when you factor in payroll taxes and the other thing, the penny, a product is not going to make that big a difference to make up for what we're going to have to do with the wages.
Follow up, Madam Chair. Would you say it would be a few pennies then? Or could you get back to me with information on that? What your projection would be?
Madam Chair, Representative Metza, I'd be happy to.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any further questions? Thank you. Yep. I do want to remind our testifiers that we want to be sensitive to everyone's time. We want to make sure everybody gets to speak, and we do have to adjourn at 4. So our next person would be Kayling Wong. Not here. Matt Bulkey, University of Minnesota. Student, sorry.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Matt Belke, and I'm currently attending the University of Minnesota. I come before you today as a concerned citizen. I'm asking you to really reconsider the drastic increase in the minimum wage. When I was 15, I was able to join the workforce, and I worked at a small garden center in Brooklyn Center known as Malmberg's. They hired me on at minimum wage, and here's really where I learned a lot of the work ethic that's really helped me out throughout the rest of my life. I had a lot of pride knowing that, one, I'm taking in money. Soon I'll be able to drive, and I'll be able to actually pay for my own car insurance. It really takes a burden off my parents, who my father was unemployed at the time. It's a very difficult time. Anything that I could do to help makes a big difference. Another thing that it did, too, is also taught me how to really live modestly and within my means. I was fiscally responsible and just another source of pride knowing that I can take care of myself if I needed to. Another thing, too, is that it really instills a sense of working hard. And that's a big thing that I think is really lacking in today's society when you look around and you say, hey, there's a toilet that needs to be cleaned. It's not a hard job. It's not a $9.50 an hour job. I've cleaned toilets in dozens of countries now. It's not a hard job to do. My biggest concern, though, is the fact that raising the minimum wage is really going to affect the youth. The Malmberg's where I was working would not be able to hire me on for $9.50. That being said, I would not gain the same experience that I had. I would not have done the same things in my life. I don't know what I would really be doing right now if it were not for that first job. And really what I'm asking you to do is please just think about those youth that are out there looking for their first job, and they want a job. But by raising the minimum wage to $9.50, you're really going to price them out of the job market. And that right there is a sign that it's just not fair. And we have to really think about the rest of the Minnesota as well. I know a lot of times we live down here in the Twin Cities, we think about Minneapolis being Minnesota. Minnesota is from McIntosh up in Polk County down to Winona. We have to think about all the small companies as well. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Belk. Any questions? Representative Metza.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess it would be, from some of the research, and I was just texting my colleague, Ryan Winkler, who is pretty good with the statistics. But I'm curious, I think it's around 60% of the jobs created recently have been service industry, where our college grads are going. And I wondered if you had just taken that into consideration, knowing that, you know, when you graduate, you could end up in a service industry that is going to be kind of the wages we're talking about now or some of where that starts. So,
Mr. Belke?
I think the issue is not the service industry. I think what we really need to be looking at is what other jobs can be created for those college grads. We say, hey, you need to go and get a degree, but then the only job you can get is working at Taco Bell. That's not right. That's an issue that needs to be addressed.
Thank you. Anything further, yeah, Representative? Senator Thomasoni.
I'm just curious, what do you think the wage should be if $9.50 is not?
I think that if we're going to speak realistically, and we're set on raising the minimum wage anyways, we think that the Minnesota state wage is embarrassing. There's no need to go above the federal minimum wage. If the minimum wage is good enough for federal workers, then I don't believe that someone working at Taco Bell should be making $9.50. I've worked at Taco Bell. Again, it's not a $9.50 job.
Anything further?
Chair, so what kind of jobs do you think should be making more than $9.50?
Mm-hmm. Well, that all depends. What kind of work are we talking about? Are we talking really, when you look at it, are we sweeping? Are we doing little minimum effort jobs that doesn't really take a lot of skill? That's where you're really trying to draw a fine line between what really makes the difference. I think that jobs where you're putting in, you have to put effort into it beforehand as well, and you really are looking to get some training out of it as well, I think those are the jobs that deserve to be paid a little bit more than just the minimum wage. And also, those companies that feel that their work is above minimum wage work, they can set their own prices.
Sure. Maybe you said this already, but I missed it. What are you majoring in at the U?
I'm majoring in history. And if you're wondering what I'm going to be doing with that, I would like to go over to the FBI and try to be an intel analyst, as it was for the Marine Corps for 5 years.
Thank you. Madam Chair, and what do you think you should get paid there?
What I think I should be paid there, it's not really up to me. What that's up to is the people that are out in Washington. If an intel analyst job, you have to really take into a lot of things into account. Where you're going to be, where you're going to be stationed, are you going to be moving around? That all has to be taken into account. If I'm going to be forced to move out to Washington, D.C., then yes, I would expect to be a little more reimbursed for that, if that answers your question.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm just curious. So if you're just sitting at a desk typing at a computer, is that hard?
Sir, it's a lot more than sitting at a desk typing at a computer. I believe that your job is a little more than just sitting at a desk typing into a computer. A lot goes into it. It's mentally fatiguing, for one. If you've ever sat at a desk for longer than 12 hours, it can be mentally fatiguing, depending on what you're doing as well. You have to know that people's lives are also going to be on the line. And that's a lot to think of.
Please be respectful to your senator.
Okay. Yes, ma'am.
That was okay. I didn't mind that.
Representative Metza?
Madam Chair, thank you. I'd say on the range that was polite. I'm just curious, I guess. I've grown up working with my hands my whole life, oftentimes just with family on projects. And I know from having 14 aunts or 13 aunts and uncles in a family of 14, how hard scrubbing toilets can be and pushing a broom around. My dad was a janitor when I grew up. He lost his job in the mines. And I'll tell you, we could have used the extra, whether it's a few cents or an extra dollar at the time. He worked his whole way through school while my mom was a, self-employed daycare provider. And, I think you really should take into consideration when you're thinking about this that work is work. And, performing work is hard no matter what it is, because you're not there with your friends and family and enjoying the things we want to do. And reason, I'm committed to passing a good minimum wage is because everyone deserves a respectable income and be compensated in a fashion that they can put a roof over their head and cover the basic costs of living. And I think that's the biggest part for me, is that the wage currently today, even at the federal level, does not provide that kind of lifestyle for the people earning it.
Thank you, Representative. I think we should move on to the next testifier, but thank you, Mr. Belke.
All right. Thank you.
Will Mayberry. Please state your name for the record.
Hey, my name is Will Mayberry. Thanks so much for the opportunity to testify here today. Actually got the name Will. I was born 1 pound, 11 ounces right here in Minneapolis. So a big shout out to anyone in the healthcare industry. Really appreciate that. Been incredibly fortunate. Graduated from the University of Wisconsin-Madison in May with BS in education. Put in 5 years there. A lot of degrees take that now. And for the most part, I've been extremely lucky. Went blind in my left eye a couple times throughout college, but relatively speaking, that's not a big deal at all. I mean, there are people with a lot worse stuff. I was incredibly fortunate and very thankful for the healthcare people at Everett Northwestern here in Minneapolis. So let me just touch on a few things. I'm originally from Hayward, Wisconsin, and I was there the other day for the American Birkebeiner. I don't know if any of you have participated or been to that event. But it reminded me of what I love so much about Hayward and St. Paul. So I feel like St. Paul has a lot of that small town mentality. It's people there who, and I really appreciated what the Greenpeace member brought up earlier today in talking about potentially redefining our values and the need to do so, as far as maybe we shouldn't measure our success based on our monetary income, how much we make. Shouldn't we maybe consider what we give to others, what we give to the environment, what we give to the old neighbor who needs her house to be shoveled? I feel like there are a lot better things to consider and judge ourselves based on rather than how much money is in our bank account. And how about providing the opportunity for all? And I feel like that starts, I was thinking about the educational system, being an education major, and I feel like in our country there's a real need to improve upon that. I've seen my sister-in-law is a stellar teacher. My mom's a great teacher. And growing up in Hayward, Wisconsin, there were some tremendous teachers, but there were also some really poor teachers. And I think the world's extremely, you know, interconnected. Economy is connected to education. Minimum wage is connected to education. Certainly, your education affects your income, affects your wage. And I feel like right now, we need to make our teacher education programs, this is a little bit off topic, but I feel like it all ties back in. We need to make our teacher education programs more competitive. When you go to think about Finland, they have the best and the brightest, highly competitive system. They have the best and the brightest in there as their teachers, raising our kids, creating the next innovators, creating the next scientists who might save your life. So I feel like, you know, it's all full circle, and we need to invest in those leaders and those teachers who will be creating the next government and the next leaders of tomorrow. And that starts with, should they be intrinsically motivated? Yes, but making $32,000 a year, what do they say now? It costs $300,000 to raise a child in today's day and age. If you're making $30,000 a year as a teacher, that's going to be tough. I really liked how you touched upon the income inequality where the top 20%, 10% I believe? Let's see here. The top 20% control about 85% of the wealth in this country. Top 20% control about 85% of the wealth in this country. I walked down the skyways. I was serving for AmeriCorps at the International Education Center in downtown Minneapolis, and I feel like you could see, you know, you could see the rift. There were people who have, there are people who have a lot, and there are people who don't. And I don't know if right now we can look the people in the eye who don't have enough to provide for their families and tell them that we're doing everything we can to provide them an education and an opportunity to be successful in this country. And I feel like that needs to be changed. Sorry to get a little off topic there.
You do need to think about wrapping it up.
Sure, no problem. I feel like it starts with the educational system in our country. The number of words that infants are exposed to that's strongly correlated. You know, a lot of people start kindergarten, five-year-olds come into kindergarten way behind. A lot of them do. And I think we need to look at ways to address that because it's easy to become disenfranchised. If you start kindergarten and you're already way behind others, it's easy to become disenfranchised. So we need to work on that pre-0 to 5 education as well as 5 to 12 and beyond. So I feel like that will greatly affect income as well as innovation, business, and all that in our country. Let's see here. Da-di-da-di-da-di, boring old statistics. Top 10% have 91 to 94% of all stocks. So the recent surge in the stock market is leaving a lot of people behind. I'm a big fan of Teddy Roosevelt. Based on his environmental principles, think about northern China. 5.5 years shorter lifetime for someone in northern China versus southern China due to the polluted air. Does this tie into minimum wage? I feel like it's all an interconnected loop, you know? And we need to think globally and on large scale as far as are those environmental costs being factored in. And how does that also relate to all this with minimum wage? I feel like there are a lot of considerations that need to be fully researched and looked into.
Please wrap it up, Mr. Sure. Mayberry, as an ending.
All right, sorry.
This is on the minimum wage.
Yes, you get it. I feel like everything is, you know, interconnected, and there's a lot to be said for how our education system affects the income and the minimum wage that people receive. I think that's about it. I don't think I necessarily have all the answers. I haven't thoroughly researched it, but I feel like it's also important to consider the environmental and education effects that I'd rather not. It's a little bit off topic, but I'd rather not, you know, live in China in certain cities where the air quality is so low that you have to wear a mask. And I feel like there are certain business costs and things that need to be factored in as far as environmental goes, and that needs to be considered along with minimum wage.
Thank you, Mr.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Anybody have any questions? Okay, thank you. Elliot Side.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, and members of the Joint Committee. Thank you very much for the opportunity to attend today. My name is Elliot Side. I'm the executive director of AFSCME Council 5. We represent 43,000 state, local government, and nonprofit workers throughout the state of Minnesota. And very thankfully for our membership, almost all our members, if not all our members, are not directly affected by this bill. But it does affect 357,000 Minnesotans who desperately need a raise. And we think that's good public policy. In the richest nation on earth, we believe it's simply wrong for anyone who works full-time to live in poverty. There's something wrong with our society when the six members of the Walton family, who own Walmart, make more than 42% of all Americans combined. I'll say it again. Six members of the Walton family who own Walmart make more than 42% of all Americans combined. I'm sure they can't, the Waltons don't have to find out what it's like to live on $5 a day to cover their food. They make that in less than a second. So this is a very important bill for a lot of people. The bill that you have, the House bill, to raise the minimum wage, and that's what AFSCME Council 5 supports, raising the maximum, the minimum wage to $9.50 an hour, improves the income of 357,000 working Minnesotans across the demographic spectrum. It improves the income of 274,000 working adults age 20 and up. It improves the income of 202,000 working women. It will improve the economic security for 137,000 children whose parents are low-wage earners. It will increase annual consumer spending in Minnesota by over $472 million. And it will boost the aggregate income of working women in this state by $256 million and the average aggregate income of working people of color of $124,416,000. I mention these things because we have what's affecting our economy and our democracy in a very negative way is the income inequality gap in this nation. It's a danger to the recovery of our economy. It is a danger to the very essence of American democracy, because you can't have those kind of disparities and then expect to continue both a strong economy and a strong democracy. I want to address the issue of the index. If the federal minimum wage had maintained its purchasing power since 1968, the minimum wage federally today would be $10.75 an hour, or $22,360 a year for a full-time worker, and that's according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. If the minimum wage had kept pace with average productivity gains, as it did in the decades leading up to the 60s, it would today be about $22 an hour, according to a 2012 analysis of BLS data by John Schmidt of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Members of the committee, Madam Chair, we have to deal with the income income opportunity gap in this country. And we in this state know that we have a major issue with disparities, educational disparities, health disparities for people who don't happen to be part of the majority population. We are facing those, and we admire this problem year in, year out. And here we have an opportunity to actually do something about it by improving the wages and incomes of people of color. We have the opportunity to take 137,000 children out of poverty. We have an opportunity disproportionately to help out African-Americans, Hispanics, and Asian Minnesotans. And we have the effect of building wealth by race. This is not just income, but wealth. And I would ask anybody who opposes this bill, if they feel they could live on $5 a day for food. I, for one, could not. And if I had to bring up my two sons, who are now 27 and 24, on $5 a day, I'm sure I wouldn't have had one son graduate the State University of New York at Albany, and the other one is about to graduate the University of Minnesota. Because you can't study, you can't learn, you can't work on that kind of diet. So there are many more statistics, many of which have been shared with this committee already, but I think we have to deal with these two issues. Income inequality and the tremendous income disparities that are taking place in our state and our nation, and how are we going to resolve that? Raising the minimum wage with an index does that, and it's about time we stopped admiring disparity problems and talking about them and started to do something concrete. We can do something right now, this week and next week, if we pass the House bill, $9.50 with an index. Madam Chair, members of the Joint Committee, thank you for the opportunity. And by the way, Aspen Council 5 passed this at our convention, 700 delegates unanimously. To pass this resolution to support the House version. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Scheid. Representative Metza would like to ask you a question.
Just got one quick one. Thank you, Madam Chair. Or actually, it's two-part, but you can answer it all together. So what I'm getting on this, if you could restate the number of members that you are representing here today for my question. I'm taking it that your members out of this are willing to pay a little bit more for their goods and services to help close the income inequality gap.
I represent 43,000 state, local government, and nonprofit workers throughout all 87 counties of Minnesota. And frankly, our folks were ready to raise the wage to $10.15 or $10.50, but they decided on trying to deal with what the real was. It takes in a family of four in the Twin Cities. It takes $14 per working family member in a 40-hour week, two family members working full-time to have a living wage. In many parts of Minnesota, and I believe, Madam Chair, Representative Metza, in your part of the state, it's around, I believe, $12.15 or $12.50 per person to do that. And, yes, my members think that Paul Wellstone was right. We all do better when we all do better.
I'd say that's a good start for our stores who might be concerned about it. Lots of customers willing to pay a little more.
$457 million more into our state's economy. The multiplier effect, when you have people on low income like this who spend their dollars, economics 101, they have a higher propensity to consume. The multiplier effect is huge. It's like getting a nuclear jump start to the Minnesota economy. It will improve our economy greatly and create many more customers in our shops and neighborhoods.
Thank you, Mr.
Scheid. Mr. Scheid, just out of curiosity, do you happen to know, out of those 42% of the people who make less money than the six Waltons all put together, do you know how many of them work for the Waltons at minimum wage?
I don't off the top of my head, but I wish I had brought it with me, Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni. I just got today the social costs of Walmart and places like that in terms of what they charge, in terms of sending their people for public benefits and what they cost the state and local governments and the federal governments. So all we're doing is we're shifting the cost to taxpayers by not paying workers what they ought to be getting paid. Every worker, public or private, ought to make a fair day's wage for a fair day's work, have health care that can take care of their family, and retire in dignity, not in poverty.
Madam Chair, if I remember correctly, I think it was around Thanksgiving that Walmart was actually having a food drive for its own employees.
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, I believe that was right, but I have to admit I was out demonstrating on University Avenue against Walmart the day after Thanksgiving. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Scheid. My next person is Damon Willis.
Hello, everybody. I'm Damian Willis. Right now, I'm looking to see minimum wage get up right now because I'm a struggling person myself. Right now, I'm taking care of me, myself, my girl, and her sister. And, like, I'm only making $200 a week, but I'm working all 7 days a week, like 10 hours a day. And it's, like, it's hard for transportation. I don't get any assistance from the state to get food stamps or anything, so that's a hard struggle right there itself. The transportation getting back and forth is even harder, and it's like we never have like any extra money to go out and do stuff to reward ourselves for the hard work I've been doing for the whole week and that thing. Then the bills are high, like super high, because I'm standing in the vacant right now. Because at the apartment complex I call, they say I have to make 2 to 3 times more than what it costs for rent there. And, like, I can't do that with $800 a month. Like, it's hard. So I'm looking forward to seeing, like, $9.50, $10 an hour for minimum wage.
Thank you. Any questions for the? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Michael McDowell.
How you all doing? I'm Michael McDowell. I'm the transit organizer with Neighborhoods Organizer for Change. I'm coming before you in support of the minimum wage, and I'm speaking from the perspective of a person who just got up living wage job, $15 an hour, when I was working for a small business beforehand, making $5.25 an hour, because the small business minimum wage is different than the federal minimum wage. So they're allowed to pay $5.25 if they're not making more than $500,000 a year. So I was making $5.25 for a while, and that was pretty hard. And I also wanted to talk about how the wage hasn't raised at all, but the cost of living has raised like significantly, I've noticed. And being a low wage worker, being turned down for housing, just like Damien said, like going in and being like a person who was homeless and looking for housing, and being turned down in apartment complexes because they're just like, you have to make one third of your you have to make one third of your rent. And so it's that was a challenge. And also, I wanted to speak on how, like, we have CEOs like Greg Steinhoffel who are making like $13,000 an hour, and you're working at Target making $7.75 when the I think the resolution would be for CEOs to get a pay cut and for their workers to get paid a little more. And like, it's crazy that our largest employer, like Walmart, they're getting subsidized billions and millions of dollars. Pretty much you get hired at Walmart and they have a training for you to get on government assistance. And I feel like it would, to raise the wage, like it would help us enormously as far as like tax wise. And we wouldn't be subsidizing these corporations with our tax dollars because they're not paying the workers enough. And also, one second here, have a couple notes. One second. And also, I wanted to stress that now going from $15.25 to $7.75 to $15 an hour, like my spending has increased like significantly. As the wage increased, I began to spend more because I had more to work with. And I feel like the raise in the wage would help better our economy because people would have more to work with and more money would be funneled into our economy. And yeah, that's I feel we need to raise this wage because a lot of corporations have been subsidized by tax money, and it's ridiculous.
That's all I got to say. Any questions?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Gloria Coles.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Gloria Coles, and I live in Minneapolis. I'm speaking in support of raising the minimum wage to $9.50 and indexing it to inflation. I'm a single mom, and now I'm a grandmother. I'm here speaking to be the voice of working mothers who cannot be here today. But they need you to raise the minimum wage so that they can be supported and help to break the cycle of poverty. When my daughter was young, I worked in the hospitality and retail industries, which are both notorious for paying low wages. I only had one child, and I had the help of my mother, but it was still a struggle. But today's single mothers, such as a young lady by the name of JC, who I've gotten to know and had an opportunity to work with in our shared commitment to community change, her struggle is even deeper. JC is a bright, intelligent, ambitious, and articulate young woman. She works multiple part-time jobs, and she is still working to raise her three children on her own in low-wage jobs. I know how she must feel. Today's working mothers are working multiple low-wage jobs, and when they get home, they have even additional roles to fulfill. They must be mother, tutor, peacekeeper, and breadwinner. They must also have the energy to be able-bodied and motivated employees. I had support. Where's the support for JC and countless other mothers, working mothers like her? You need to raise the minimum wage. Raise the minimum wage because single mothers like JC want, need, and deserve to move beyond survival. They need the opportunity to thrive.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you, Ms. Coles. Any questions? We have reached close to the end time here, and I need to ask, do you plan on meeting on Saturday?
Madam Chair, this being the first week of session, I think I'll decline a Saturday hearing.
Thank you. Okay. We do plan to meet on Monday at 4 p.m. and 107 again here, and look forward to hearing from the DEED and Department of Labor regarding a report on Minnesotans in low-wage sector. So we could continue with John Franz, but Representative Winkler may need to step out shortly.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Franz, and any other testifiers who are here, I apologize. I have a 9-year-old coming off the bus at 4:25, and he forgot his boots at home this morning. So leaving him out in the cold is not a very good option, and it's at least a half an hour to get back. So I have to run.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Mr. Franz.
Okay. Yes, so good afternoon, Senator Eaton, committee members. Excuse me. My name is John Fraz. I'm from Northfield, Minnesota, and I'm obviously here in support of raising the wage and indexing it to inflation. The reason I believe this is the right thing to do is that after a lifetime of working for poverty wages, I am now living on poverty Social Security. I started working when I was 16 years old. I'm 66 now. I still work a few hours a week for a small business in Dundas. I've done all kinds of work, factory work, temporary work, ag work, transportation work, retail work, kitchen work. Over 50 years of work experience, I've averaged about $8 an hour. So in 2009, at the lowest point of the Great Recession, I lost my truck driving job through no fault of my own, and after exhausting my unemployment benefits and still not able to find new employment, I was forced to take Social Security retirement benefits 2 years early, 2 years before I planned on doing it. And so now I find myself trying to get by on $807 a month. So if I didn't have Medicare and food support, I'd be in a world of hurt. So, excuse me, lost my place here. So my point is that I believe in a wealthy state like Minnesota, we can do better. People that have worked their whole lives should be able to retire with dignity. So I'm asking you to please raise the wage to $9.50 so that today's working families can look forward to something better than a poverty-level retirement. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Franz. Any questions? Russell Barnes.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman and representatives of the committee. My name is Russell Barnes. I live in Minneapolis. I'm currently a student at the University of Minnesota studying journalism, and I'm here to speak on raising the wage to $9.50 and then indexing to inflation. I come from a family where minimum wage was the norm, as well as low-wage jobs, and alongside that was struggle. My mother, she worked at a gas station. My sister worked at a fast food restaurant, and she's also the mother to my 3-year-old niece, and I currently work at the bookstore on campus. Getting by is not the easiest thing for me to do. Many believe that college students work for a little quote-unquote extra cash, but the reality is that it's different for many people, myself included. I work to stay afloat, and fear is constantly hovering over my head. What if textbooks are more expensive than normal for one semester? What if my laptop for school suddenly breaks and I have to pay to get that fixed? What if I'm not able to find a job that reduces my worries after college? And I'm really blessed that I haven't had a major crisis in my life that has left me financially crippled, but I always worry that such an occasion could happen when I'm least expecting it and I would have no support. I'd like to think I could ask my family, but with my circumstances, I really can't. I can't ask my mom. She's struggling to support her own self, let alone my sister and my niece. And then there's me asking my extended family, but I don't really have a relationship with my extended family. But regardless of that, I don't think money should be a burden to myself or my family or to anyone who is trying to better their lives, whether that's trying to pursue a better education and get a better job or whether it's working full time. And it's true that many young people, especially college students, would really benefit from raising the minimum wage, but it would also relieve the burden on themselves as well as their families, including my own. Working to get through school, not necessarily for extra cash, but to cover living expenses and that my parents can't necessarily help me with, it's becoming increasingly expensive and increasingly stressful as living costs are continuously increasing, but the minimum wage is not. I really strongly encourage that you support raising the minimum wage to $9.50 and indexing it to inflation to reduce the burden on the many families and students that are in similar situations to myself and my family. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Fletcher, any questions? Thank you. We're past 4 o'clock. I'm wondering if Steve Fletcher could come back Monday.
Yes, I can.
Thank you. So with that, we will adjourn till Monday at 4 o'clock here.
You want to take one more?